Hey, Dubanners, how are you doing? This next episode is fascinating. We suggested to us by Rob, one of the Dubanners. We spoke to our next guest, who is an investigative journalist on behalf of the German national television into doping. That's what he specializes in. So we go into details about the Chinese doping scandal that we've talked about to do with the air conditioning. We talk about some of the troubles with whitewashing, the size of sports now, and how doping works in different countries. So if you've wanted to understand a bit more about what the flaws are and what's being done to try and change them, then this is the episode for you. Take it away, Nick.
They're bad, they're boys, and occasionally they talk about running. Yes, it's the Bad Boy Running Podcast with your hosts, Jody Rainsford and David Heller. Come back. Baby, come back.
With a bye, 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 bye. With a bye, 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 bye. I must admit I was a clone to be messing around. But that doesn't mean that you have to leave town.
Hey, Dubanners, welcome to Bad Boy Running. And it's quite often we'll get suggestions from our listeners of someone to interview. But thanks to Rob Eaves, who suggested our next guest, because we've been talking about the Chinese doping scandal and particularly about just the weirdness of how they got away with doping, it seems, because they just said the ventilation shaft had drugs in it. And that's why everyone in this hotel had cheated. You know, nothing to do with them being drug dopers themselves, but just a simple, you know, ventilation system mix up. And Robert suggested that we speak to our next guest because he was actually involved in the reporting and the undercover and the discovery of that story. So we wanted to find out more about the details of that. But actually, now that we've chatted beforehand, get an understanding of really how investigative journalism works these days and how that interacts with dopey stories, with stories of whitewashing in politics and various other things. So welcome to the podcast, the wonderful Nick Butler. Yay!
Hi.
Thanks for coming, Nick. Where should we begin this story? You're based out of Berlin at the moment. Your role is doing these kind of investigative journalism, but how it almost is. I'm so delighted that you exist, because it, to me, it almost feels as if the world no longer had people like you, that this type of journalism was too expensive, or there wasn't enough clicks in it. So how did you get into what you're doing?
Yeah, that's completely true. There's fewer and fewer sort of being able to finance investigative journalism, as you said. But we're very lucky. We have a small team, small production company based in Berlin or near Berlin. And basically all our stories are for ARD, which is German public service television. So we're very lucky that they are prepared to finance.
So you're like the BBC?
Yeah, basically like the BBC. Yeah, and I think... not sure I meant to say this, but there's the same discussions in Germany as there are in Britain about paying the license fee, and they realize that financing investigative journalism is a good way to sort of justify what they do. So they're prepared to do that. But we're aware that there's not many equivalent teams that have the sort of time and resources to invest in these sorts of stories. So yeah.
Interesting. So they almost need to be able to hold up public good that's come from these investigations and the public interest, and say that without us, we wouldn't be able to uncover these stories. Well, then that's quite interesting then that they see unrooting people cheating in sport essentially as one of the big areas that are of public interest then.
Yeah, well, in Germany, doping, which is, I guess, our core sort of interest, it became a particularly big issue because of Jan Ulrich, the cyclist, who he was obviously a big name. And that, I think, there was questions as to why the media hadn't done more to expose him beforehand. And I think it sort of came out of that. But I mean, what I've found And I guess most people know as well, is that when all these scandals come out, not just in sport, but in politics and whatever, in business, is pretty much usually people going to the media and through the media that they come out. Is you can't really rely on organizations to expose themselves. So I hope that, yeah, that people still investing in investigative journalism, because it's still important.
Because how, like, so were you, is your background in kind of sports science or just general journalism or?
I worked for a website called Inside the Games, which was based in Milton Keynes, or was, and basically covered the business and politics of the Olympics particularly. So I always wanted to be just a straight up sports commentator, and struggled to find somewhere out of university, and ended up working there, which was great because you just traveled the world basically writing about sports. And then I wasn't sure what to do after that. And yeah, it's pretty difficult, as I imagine people know, to get into newspapers or to find jobs. So I knew the guy who's now my boss, the head of our team here, Hayo Seppelt, and I was sort of moaning to him about it all. And then he said, why don't you move to Berlin and work for me? Which was a good decision.
I mean, doubly sweet. Milton Keynes to Berlin as well. What a bonus. And how does it tend to work? How do you because from our perception, these stories almost just appear. They just pop up. But then there are some which are almost inevitably going to happen that are linked to the Olympic cycle or linked to just general testing. Are you a Leeds focused organization where you get tip-offs and you follow those, or does it tend to be more that where there's smoke there's fire and you start rooting around in those areas, and how do you then actually try and uncover the actual stories?
It's a bit of both. So one of the other big investigations I've worked on was about weightlifting a few years ago now, and that we saw a lot of smoke from years of doping, and we heard a lot of rumors about covering up off doping, and we sort of went from there. So we approach people, whereas other stories like this swimming one, sort of we hear information and we hear you obviously have to speak to people, and then it often takes a lot of time to prove or get the sufficient proof that you need to do a story on it. And yeah, often timing is important, and people are more prepared to cooperate at certain times. But yeah, it can completely depend, basically. We approach stories in all sorts of ways.
And how easy is it to actually uncover truth? Because a lot of doping now is either systematic, but built into authoritarian regimes where there is the fear of being locked up or just being disappeared for anyone who speaks, or it's against people's self-interest, or it's in communities where you clearly stand out as not being from those communities. So how do you actually get to the truth, and how hard is it to actually uncover what's happening?
It's super hard. I mean, I think we only really scratch the surface. And then you mentioned authoritarian regimes. There's also definitely a lot of doping in the Western world, where you can hire armies of lawyers to deal with any potential sources. It's not easy. But basically you're reliant, usually to get as far as publishing a story, we're reliant on building the trust of whistleblowers and brave people who are prepared to speak out or help in some way. But it's very, it's pretty difficult. And it's interesting because I think there haven't been as many big doping scandals in the last few years, and some of the sports organizations claim that's because there's less doping, and a lot of people aren't sure. But I think it's very, very difficult to catch people, and it's often if you do have some sort of hints and clues, it's very, very hard to prove it to a level that gets past our lawyers and allows you to do a story.
And with, because whistleblowers, we mentioned before we were recording about the Stepanovs and how they've described their journey, where one of them, she was an athlete, he was a tester, and they almost had this revelation where they realized what the truth was themselves, and just their decency is really what drove them to then to come clean. But is that typically what you have to rely on, or is there more of a wooing process where you're having to like figure out who the people are who have almost chinks in their morality that you can then start to actually work on them and try and actually get them to see the bigger picture?
Yeah, well, it's more sort of a mutual trust building process, I would say, that we have to understand why people want to come forward and what motivations they have, which can differ, but also they have to trust us and realize that we're going to only publish the story in a fair way or whatever. And the Stepanovs, so as I said beforehand, the team before I joined it here in Berlin did the original story, which helping them get out of Russia, and then the story which prompted Grigory Rodchenkov, the Moscow lab director, to get out of Russia too, leading to Icarus. And I think they were some of the bravest and sort of purest, if you like, whistleblowers that I've certainly come across. And they wanted to do the right thing and were prepared to basically take huge risks by basically going into meetings with the architects of state doping in Russian athletics wearing cameras. And it was amazing that they were prepared to do that. And it doesn't happen too often.
Yeah, especially as, I mean, even now, it's not, they will be nervous because Putin bears grudges, people disappear. Not even disappear, people are very publicly killed around the world.
They're outside Russia and not public about all the details of their lives. And
would you say, because what would you say the main motivations are then for these whistleblowers? For them, it was that morality. But actually within, if you're, say, for example, in China, there isn't really a huge motivation for you to try and, as a Chinese individual, to uncover cheating in your own country, that benefits your government, that benefits your community. Similar in Kenya, right? What's the benefit of exposing people that are bringing success and money? So what would you say the typical motivation tends to be for whistleblowers?
Well, it's quite encouraging how people often want to do the right thing. But there's all sorts of other political motivations, which we have to work out what they are. And sometimes it's not as black and white, but they might be releasing important information. Well, they might not always have completely non-beneficial motivations, if that makes sense, for doing what they're doing. There might be a sort of agenda at play, but we have to sort of understand that. And it doesn't mean that what they say isn't accurate and useful, but there's all sorts of different things.
So we mentioned the Chinese story then with the ventilation shaft, which I don't really understand how that is even a viable excuse as why everyone's doped. How did that story come about?
Well, we'd heard about it. Well, we sort of, I guess, began investigating about 2 years ago. We heard the basics of the story and had a long process of trying to find out more. And then we eventually received this report from the Chinese anti-doping agency, which was basically their explanation, which they gave to the World Aquatics, the swimming governing body, and to the World Anti-Doping Agency, and which we was, as far as we could see, just basically accepted. So basically what they said is, 23 swimmers all tested positive for the same substance. It was a very cleverly written report in that they sort of excluded all sorts of things. So they said, it wasn't an important competition, therefore they couldn't have been, there's no reason to deliberately.
There's no motivation.
It, which, It's sort of when you first read it, it makes sense, and then you go through, and there was a lot of science which didn't really sort of seem irrelevant. Like some of them tested positive, then negative, then positive, but that can happen when you're dealing with very low levels of a substance. And then they sort of built to the crescendo, which was that there were all sorts of delays for COVID, both in delivering, like analyzing the sample and then reporting the sample. And they eventually went back to the hotel where it happened, and the Ministry of Public Security, which was basically an apparatus of the Chinese state, did an investigation, and they found tiny traces of this substance, trimetazidine, in, as you said, in the ventilation shaft, but also in the spice containers. And also, they described it as a sludge coming, which was sort of a drainage out of the kitchen. So
did they then connect it to how they thought that then got in the food?
They basically, their hypothesis was that it had somehow got into the spice containers first, and then during the cooking process it had got into the air conditioning, and then after the cooking it had gone into the drainage, and that they then presumed that it got into the food and the athletes had eaten the food, but there was no proof of that. And also it seems strange that this was 2.5 months later, at least, probably more, that they found all of this in the kitchen. And they said, oh, because of COVID, the hotel had been shut and there wasn't really much cleaning going on. And they claimed they had CCTV showing there hadn't been much cleaning. But this substance, trimetazidine, isn't found in food. It shouldn't be found in a kitchen. It's a prescription medication. So we couldn't really understand why, if they had CCTV, they couldn't have worked out who, presumably someone in the kitchen staff, had been taking it or whatever, but they never found that out. So we felt, basically, in the anti-doping rules, they have a reversal of the presumption of innocence. So if you test positive, you are guilty unless you can prove otherwise. And it seemed to us, they hadn't, well, I think it seemed to everyone, but they hadn't done that. They hadn't proven otherwise. They had a vague sort of hint. So we couldn't really understand why this had been accepted. And we presumed all the way through that there might be something else we'd missed. And we had this big decision. Do we ask for the World Anti-Doping Agency early on in the story, or do we wait till the end? And we waited till the end, till the last 3 or 4 days before asking them questions, which I think was the right decision. But yeah, there never was really an explanation.
Well, explain to us that process then, because we've spoken to Rob Kohler quite a few years ago, where he was talking about one of the issues with anti-doping being that the countries are in many ways self-governing. And so, you know, your own police. So it comes down to WADA to accept they still have the choice of either agreeing with the Chinese doping agency or disagreeing. Is that right? Where does the power lie, and how does the decision making work? Do you know?
Well, they basically said, they've tried to say since the stories were published, that when this report landed on my desk in June 2021, so 6 months after the cases, that they basically had a decision then whether to appeal it or not, which they can do under the rules. And they decided they didn't have any counter evidence, so couldn't appeal it. But what we think was really strange and different to the handling of virtually every other doping case is when the positive tests were initially put into the sort of world database they have in March, so 3 months earlier. Usually at that point, the case would be published, the athletes would be provisionally suspended, they would be disqualified from the competition that they were tested positive at, and none of that happened. And we still, I wouldn't say, have really had an explanation as to why that was. There's been this sort of the rules are written in a sort of very open way. There's room for interpretation, and they're claiming that because of the suspicion of contamination, they allowed them to sort of investigate without making it public. But as far as we can tell, that's not really what the rules say you should do. And then at that point, they didn't know it was contamination anyway. So it's sort of irrelevant. So WADA are definitely, to answer your question.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm waffling. But WADA have the power to do more, but they're limited with dealing with places like China. And it's an interesting one.
When you say that they... So there was almost the rules weren't followed or adhered to when these Chinese neighbors are first caught. So what do you think happened then? Is there the head of the Chinese doping authority is heavily pressuring or on the phone to the head of WADA? Is there someone junior who doesn't know what's going on and therefore allows it? Like, how do you think it comes to the situation where they're not just banned while they wait to discover what the reason is?
It's very hard to tell. I suspect it wouldn't be as sort of blatant as that, but I really don't know. I mean, the sort of cynical view, I guess, is that this was all happening. We're involving some very big names in swimming just before the Olympics in Tokyo. And then 6 months later was the Winter Olympics in China. So it was, I guess, not perfect for anyone in sport for a big doping case involving Chinese athletes, Chinese swimmers at this point. But I obviously can't speculate too much, but I would suggest it was just sort of difficult to get to the bottom of it. So rather than try... easier to accept their explanation. But just to conclude, what I think athletes and people in other countries are annoyed with is that's not how other countries are treated. And WADA often, there's a lot of cases where WADA have intervened and not accepted excuses and pushed for stronger sanctions. So it's about consistency.
Because to me, it almost suggests there's a more holistic view from someone at WADA who's trying to play sports politics based off what's happening in competitions. Whereas actually that surely if WADA should be uncoupled from that type of decision-making, it should just be, we throw the book at everyone independent of politics. Yeah. And it's someone else who then has a conversation about how does this affect the sport. It shouldn't be the people, the police shouldn't also be the people who are assessing the politics of it, right?
The problem is that WADA is 50% funded by governments around the world and 50% funded by sports, essentially the International Olympic Committee. And they have a rotating presidency. It's either a sporting person or a government person. So they're not independent. Everyone's got skin in the game, and the whole sort of fabric of it is built on sort of conflicts of interest. There's been a number of people in WADA who've been directly implicated in covering up doping, or at least two people, a guy in biathlon and a guy in weightlifting. So yeah, there's a lot of questions you can make about the governance.
And so is there a movement? Because I naively at times have thought, well, we've got Sebastian Cohen now, he's a good guy, he's one of us, he'll sort everything out. And is there a movement? I'd have thought there's enough people from countries, I'd have hoped there'd be enough people from countries who are genuinely wanting to stamp out doping, that there would be a movement to try and embed a presidency that is independent. Like, do you hear that as being something that people are trying to move towards, or is that an impossibility because of the constitution of how WADA is set up?
You hear that a lot about independence is always thrown around as a word, but I think the way I see it is sports. So I think the key people behind WADA of the International Olympic Committee, which is the president is Thomas Bach, a German. And I feel for them, they do care about doping to some extent, but they don't let it get in the way of some of their other priorities, which include hosting the Olympics and making a lot of money through television and sponsorship revenues. So it is just not always, in an ideal world, I think they wouldn't have doping there, but they wouldn't want the biggest names of the Olympics to be exposed, and they wouldn't want their product to be damaged. So it's they're sort of limited in how far they're prepared to actually deal with it.
Which is, I mean, frustrating, because actually it's short term, not damaging the product, long term, massively damaging more product. Because actually, if you stamp it out now, sure, it might hurt you now, but after the 80s and all that doping, all the doping scandal, there was a time when it felt as if people were genuinely scared to dope. And even the Tour de France now, after how many people had the book thrown at them, while I don't think people necessarily assume the whole of the tour is completely clean, I'd say it's more sophisticated, at least. So it's people have got PEDs as opposed to doping, and people are probably microdosing as opposed to taking EPO. And so that level of fear does, the big stick is all we've got. And so if you don't use it, then you're actually encouraging surely more dopers in the long term, which is the frustrating thing. So so with this case in China, when you then found out the information, how much of that story is you just saying what was in the report, and what was the investigation in addition to it? Like, how did you go about that, and what did you discover?
That's a good question. So we were obviously limited in what we could do in China on the ground. So we did have people helping us in China. We went to the hotel where it supposedly happened.
Did you have a meal and then run 100 meters and just swim 100 meters and see?
We had a look at the air conditioning. There wasn't really that much we could do there, because it's so long after now, we couldn't really go snooping around, and obviously it's quite difficult to do that in China. So we basically just tried to verify the science and the rules and the laws of anti-doping, which is not simple, because the rules and the laws of anti-doping are, very, as I said before, they're very sort of open and confusing, and different people interpret it in different ways. So we realized quite early on that the story was sort of as much about the anti-doping system and WADA as it was about Chinese or possible Chinese doping. But we did, for example, we went to a laboratory in Germany and did a sort of experiment where we looked at this substance, and if you could say get it on your hands, or if a pill could break up and contaminate a kitchen, and did some scientific experiments like that. So and it was just, apart from that, just trying to speak to as many people as possible. But we were also conscious that if we spoke to too many people, that the story would sort of be released or killed in a way. And it's interesting, because when we eventually, so we were working together with the New York Times, and we coordinated, so we both sent questions to the relevant organizations on the same day, about, I think it was 4 days before publication. And then the story, a version of the story, suddenly appeared in the Australian, on an Australian newspaper. And we still don't know how that happened, or who gave them the information. But so we then had this massive panic and had to publish early. And yeah, it was an interesting weekend.
Have you followed up with it? Like, so do you think you hacked and it was fed to them, or?
No, we don't think we're not sure, basically. One possibility is that the organizations we contacted with questions maybe felt that it would be beneficial for the story to come out elsewhere, to sort of dilute it a bit. It's a classic. There was a famous instance of that happening with Lance Armstrong, when the Sunday Times, I think it was, had information about him working with Michelle Ferrari, the doping doctor, and when they asked him about it, he rang up another newspaper and told them that he was working with him on a one-off basis to target the world hour record.
I think so, he ran He rang Heat magazine, didn't he? He was like,
he broke it to
readers' wives. And
But we don't know. We don't know what happened this time, to be clear. But it was it basically I got a call. I was staying in a hotel next to our office because we were basically behind with making the documentary. And then I got a banging on my door at 6 a.m. saying, we've got to publish, and we hadn't even finished. So yeah, it made it a fun Saturday morning.
Oh God, how heartbreaking.
Yeah, but it's not that big a problem really, because yeah, we managed to do it, and yeah, it's
but then I mean
stressful at the time.
Maybe you're different to me, but if I've put the work in on something, I want to get the glory, man. I want to, if you sharpen the knife, you want to plunge it in the heart, don't you?
Yeah, but I mean, I think most, it was widely reported as a New York Times and ART story. So yeah, we don't know how the Australian newspaper got it. So we're really not sure. But yeah, we had a lot more detail and the actual report and everything. So yeah, it's certainly an interesting story.
And it maybe acted as a bit of a almost a sizzler to your steak, potentially, as I could see it. But so do you understand how doping is reported locally in China or say Kenya? Like, because I do wonder when you have Kate, like this is 23 high profile swimmers. Would anyone in China know through any means other than a VPN that this has happened?
A good question, because there was a big press conference a couple of days later and there wasn't a single Chinese journalist certainly asking a question there. I think it was reported in China, but only with their like deny fake news allegations, yeah, in a certain way. It certainly hasn't been followed up properly, but Kenya is completely different. I think in Kenya there is at least a willingness to a certain degree amongst the government and amongst sport in Kenya and I guess journalists, yeah, definitely journalists, to clamp down on doping, and they admit that they have a problem and have put a lot of resources into trying to sort it out. So you can't really compare the two, I guess.
And because we've recently had, I can't remember the gentleman's name, you know, world record holder for the 10K and numerous other athletes banned. It's been over 200 in the last 5 years, I think, athletes. Do you know whether there is shame for those athletes returning? If they're going back to Iten where they live or to their villages, is there an awareness of what's happened? And do you think there is that element of I've cheated my fellow athletes, I've cheated potentially fellow Kenyans out of success, and it has a negative impact on their lives, on the stain on them, on their moral character and their sporting achievements forever? Or do you think it's perceived differently locally?
My colleagues were actually there recently. I haven't been, but I think whatever negative consequences there are is outweighed by the benefits of winning races. And the benefits of being a runner and traveling and in Kenya, I think being able to provide not just for yourself, but for your family and lots of other people is huge. So the benefits of doping are so big, they outweigh the downside, I would say.
But still, yeah, I mean, absolutely, because it's not about sport, it's about life, it's about survival, it's about financing your family. But is it the case though that money's in the bank, they go back to their community, and everyone in the community is like, that's the drugs cheat, they almost walk around with their head held low, you know, they're no longer invited to run a track, you know, they're not seen as being an Olympic champion, but they've got the money in the bank, so it's worth it? Or is it almost seen as, because my fear is that it's almost seen as part of the game, and part of the system.
Yeah, I don't want to. I'm not completely sure on Kenya, but I think you're right. I mean, we spoke. My colleagues recently interviewed a few athletes, and these were just the ones who were prepared to speak to journalists.
Yeah.
And none of them admitted doping deliberately. They all said, oh, my doctor gave me this. I took this by mistake. So I feel that even if you're caught, it's quite common not to fully come clean.
Yeah.
And you see, that's not just a Kenyan thing. You see that all over. You see so many, the list of excuses for failing drugs tests are amazing. And it's rare. It's very, very rare for athletes to come out and actually say, yes, I doped. And then if they do, they generally only say, I doped. I started 1 week before I was caught. It's extremely rare for someone to come out and say, I've doped my entire career. I felt that was the only way to succeed, and this is how I did it. And I feel if doping in sport is really going to be cleaned up, that's what needs to happen more. But I think generally athletes have more to lose for this sort of a murder kind of silence. And people realize that even after they're caught, there's more risks of fully coming clean.
I do have a lot of sympathy for that argument that in Kenya they don't know what they're taking, because you know I've been on tour with lots of athletes who are from I'd say less developed countries where they are fairly clueless about everything they're eating, and they have no, they'll turn up without the right trainers, they'll turn up without a water bottle, so they'll eat whatever's in front of them. They won't ask any questions because it's not the culture. So I can believe that to be massively true, and I don't know how you instill in people that you can't just take what your doctor gives you. So then, what are the other stories you've kind of, well, firstly, what has there been any ramifications from this article? Like, did it enforce that the athletes were retrospectively banned? Do you think that could happen? Has it changed how the system's reporting? Or
not yet. So basically, WADA have come under a lot of pressure. I think not completely successfully tried to explain their decision-making process. They've had a lot of criticism internally from other anti-doping organizations who've said, hold on, this is not how we deal with cases and you make us deal with cases. And then they've commissioned a prosecutor to look into how they dealt with it, but with quite a, I would say, limited mandate to do that. And that, I think a report is due certainly before the Olympics in the next few weeks. I suspect that nothing will really happen. I think there's no real suggestion that the swimmers are going to face any consequences. It will be interesting how other athletes deal with them, and a lot of them will be in Paris. The only thing that might change is if more information comes to light about the circumstances of what happens. But we'll see. Yeah.
And are you nervous about being involved in the story because of the way the Chinese government are an authoritarian government?
Not really. We obviously have to be careful with security of like online particularly. And we've had a lot of legal threats from the Chinese government, from the foreign ministry, and also from WADA, but not actual, just threatened. Just sort of, we will sue, like we haven't actually received any. And in fact, we haven't received anything suggesting anything we reported wasn't correct. So yes, it's always a risk. So the head of our team, Hayo, is not, he got his, he's basically not been allowed back into Russia since his stories in 2015, 2016. Mm. And he's had quite a lot of threats from people in Russia. It's not quite clear who they are, so has had to be careful. So yeah, there are risks, but not to a too worrying degree.
And would you know, for example, if you were a swimmer who wasn't on that list from China, do you get a sense that they're annoyed that they're doping?
From the Chinese swimmers.
Yeah. If you're like, how come they get the juice and I'm sat here having chow
Yeah,
mein
we're
without
not.
any special sauce?
It's very hard to talk to these people because they're very restricted. But there's a lot of questions as to, I think there's a lot of questions about why it was these athletes and not others, and obviously others didn't get tested, so we don't know how widespread it could be, or we really don't know anything about whether they were deliberately doping or not, or if there was another explanation. All we really know is this kitchen explanation doesn't really make sense. But yeah, I think there's certainly quite a lot of resentment from athletes in other countries, some of whom have spoken out. And yeah, well, I was at the Rio Olympics in swimming, where there was a lot of tension between Russian swimmers and those from other countries. And yeah, that might happen again, I guess, in Paris.
And we've when we spoke to Stefanos, I felt genuinely sorry for Maria that she was denied the opportunity to race clean, really.
Yeah, I mean, the best example of that is East Germany here, which is another reason why doping is a topic they really care about in Germany, because all these athletes were given vitamins, and maybe some of them, I guess, knew, some of them didn't know. And basically you had to take these substances to be on the national team, or even be at a high level, not in the national team. And if you they do what we call washout testing, where they do sort of secret off the books testing before allowing you to go to international competitions, and if you tested positive there, you were just out. And yeah, and it's kind of a horrible environment, and it's got better to some extent, but not completely.
So we mentioned a few other stories that you've worked on. What would you say are the ones that are most surprising to people?
Well, I'm not sure anything would be that surprising. Well, we our main Our number one thing is doping, but we also have covered a lot of just sports corruption. And yeah, I worked on a long investigation in 2020, 2019, 2020 on weightlifting. And it was, yeah, basically this guy had been basically in charge of the World Federation for 40 years. He also was on the board of WADA. And he basically ran this empire where he was using doping cases as a way to sort of build politics, and he was protecting some countries and not others. And yeah, I guess it didn't surprise that many people, but it was sort of amazing how to what extent he got away with it for so long.
Was he doing that for votes or for like
Yeah,
bribes or
we could
for?
never quite prove all of it, but yeah, there was certainly a lot of allegations that he was promising countries medals and promising to be more lenient. We never quite got to the bottom of that. But that's been an allegation also in boxing in the Olympics, that certain countries, and not in terms of doping, in terms of match fixing. And that certainly happened to some extent at the Rio Olympics, and I think at many others,
Are you allowed
where.
to hint at which countries in particular?
Well, it's not quite clear how it was organized, whether countries were being protected or individuals. But there was an Irish boxer called Michael Conlon, who was very he was in this ridiculous bout where he landed about twice as many punches and lost, and everyone could see that it wasn't right. And he sort of went off message, and in the interview described the Boxing Federation as a load of cheats and corrupt. And instead of looking
Amazing.
into the bout, they punished him, and they basically banned him, and he said, "I don't care, I'm going professional anyway." And then it all sort of snowballed from there. There were a few that were too blatant, and they ended up every judge who was officiating in Rio in boxing got dismissed, and they've sort of half got to the bottom of it. And yeah, it certainly seems there was some sort of organized attempt to protect certain countries. But as ever, it hasn't fully come out, because there's no real appetite within sport to fully investigate.
And how do you think you can protect about this? Because we kind of linking to the situation in Kenya, really, it's there's poor countries in the world, and sport is power and money. So how do we protect? Because really, a clean sport and a fair competition is quite a privileged position to be in. To say, I'm only doing this because I want to be clean, as opposed to I'm doing this because I need to feed my family. And also voting rights for, you look at things like the UN, it's kind of screwed because it has the UN Security Council, which gives more power to certain countries. But to a certain extent, that's necessary if you're having, you need a system along those lines if you're trying to ensure that poorer countries aren't able to be bought and empowered by money or by politics. Yeah. So can you see a system for doping or for ensuring there isn't whitewashing in sport, or there's fair bids, or there's fair boxing? Like, can that ever exist given the world is so imbalanced?
The trouble is, every time there's a scandal, they talk a lot about reforms, but not much really changes. And everyone has skin in the game and there's no real independence. So it's very hard. And I mean, you look at a lot of sports, but FIFA, for example, the whole voting model is based around giving development funding to small federations in return for their votes. I guess
Jack Warner, basically.
Yeah, well, he was the most blatant example. But yeah, you see it all the time now with Infantino. He'll go off around the Pacific Islands or Africa, and he'll notch up 20, 30 votes by promising funding that only the incumbent can do. And that's the playbook that we see right across sport. And a lot of these presidents who've been in their positions for years and years, they have a power base in the smaller countries. But at the same time, it's not just for smaller countries that engage in doping. And I think it's a problem in much bigger countries as well, and hasn't fully been addressed there. And they do it in different ways. Some of these like therapeutic use exemptions and things that are, you mentioned microdosing, things that are not quite 100% banned, like salbutamol, asthma, but are sort of abused. So yeah, it's interesting. I think there's a sort of, it works in different ways in different parts of the world, but it's not just a sort of small, less developed country problem.
And do you view that as deeply depressing, or do you just see it as part of the cost of sport? And do you think there is a, do you think you guys can make a difference, or do you think ultimately that the system is stuck?
I think we can't really make a massive difference. For example, the sports which I think have a huge doping problem that barely nobody even associates with doping, like football, tennis, rugby, basketball, all these sports, there's so much money involved. Even if you could find out things, it would be very hard to report with the lawyers and the money involved. So yeah, I think we're probably, as journalists, I feel we're the best way for stories to come out and doing a better job than other organizations, but ultimately not only really tip of the iceberg. And well, really what makes a difference is when law enforcement gets involved, when the FBI did their investigation into FIFA, and that makes a difference. But obviously they have limited time and resources to do that. And it's interesting because this new law came into Congress in America called the Rodchenkov Act, where it allows the FBI to basically go after sports organizations that or anyone that can basically impact American athletes. So there's been one or two quite good investigations into doping rings and athletes doping and the entourage behind them. But when that law came into force, the World Anti-Doping Agency went to Congress and lobbied against it, because they basically said it could break up the whole anti-doping system. But I would say that they didn't want to be threatened, and they didn't want anyone else sort of muscling in on their territory. So yeah, there's generally, I would say, not enough is being done to deal with all these issues.
And we mentioned a bit about whitewashing and sport. Yes. And like, given we've seen with the Commonwealth Games, no one wants it. It's too expensive. And that you could argue the same for pretty much any major event now. Do you think there is an alternative to whitewashing, or are we just going to have to take money from tyrants and from oppressive regimes?
Yeah, the trouble is with all these events, they've snowballed and they're so big and they take so much money to organize that, yeah, it's fewer and fewer countries are prepared to do that, and sports bodies aren't really prepared to scale back to a meaningful degree because they won't get as much revenue. And it always comes down to revenue. So it's, yeah, and then that means you have to, yeah, if Saudi Arabia want to throw all the money they have at it, then so be it. So yeah, it's a bit depressing. And what we've seen with the Olympics is they've changed the voting process, whereas it's not this big open public year-long process anymore, where there's often referendums which they'll lose. They're sort of trying to do it like a business tender behind closed doors, and you can kind of understand why they're doing that, and it avoids some bribery and stuff, but it presents other problems because it's so secretive and intransparent. But the way they awarded Brisbane the next Summer Olympics, the 2032, for example, and yes, it's a problem because, yeah, and the Commonwealth Games is a good example. Just not many. I think it's got to the point a while ago where only probably Britain and Australia are really capable of having the resources to host it, and even they are now less interested in doing so every time.
Yeah, it's the only way we get medals, isn't it? So we kind of need that to have athletes to I think who can't
Well,
we
yeah,
interviewed
but
it.
they tried to give it to Durban. They did give it to Durban. Was it for 2022? My memory's bad, but and it just. They pulled out in the end. Nothing. It wasn't working. The preparations weren't going well. So it's kind of difficult. And the Commonwealth Games is an interesting one. Like no one here in Germany understands the point of it. But I was in Gold Coast in 2018, and I thought it was great. So it's a good event, but I can understand why people say it doesn't really have a place in the modern kind of world.
I think whenever you go, well, when we used to enslave half the world, all the people, and you mentioned we briefly mentioned about before we were recording about Turkmenistan and taking the world cycling there. I mean, you've been out there to one of these games where it how is it for athletes where you've qualified for a World Cup or World Championships to go to a place that is very much autocratic and that they themselves know is only there for whitewashing? Does it have a big impact on the athletes?
Well, athletes always say that, oh, we don't care where we compete. We just go in and go out and focus on the competition. That's what they're told to say. But obviously, look at the example of Jordan Henderson, for example, in football. It's not always easy for them, I think. Yeah, Turkmenistan, I was sent there twice, once for a meeting, once for they were hosting this event called the Asian Indoor and Martial Arts Games. And they'd spent millions and millions on building all these new stadiums for this event. And it's just a sort of we there were two there was a hotel that we were staying in, and we gradually realized that it's not usually open, and all the staff had been flown in from London. They
So
all
they're all
thought they were
dreadful
going to
staff, were
Turkey.
they? All unskilled
Yeah,
and
it was all kind of fake. And yeah, it's really it's this beautiful, if people don't know Turkmenistan, it's this beautiful city called Ashgabat, the capital, and they've got huge, the biggest gas reserves in the world, and everything's made out of marble. Everything is beautiful, but no one's there, and you gradually realize that all normal people are living somewhere that you're not allowed to go to. And we had these sort of people who were with us the whole time, who were sort of like security, who would tell us where we could go and where we couldn't go. And yeah, it's just a really sort of surreal experience. But these sorts of countries are, I guess, the only ones willing to often host these events. And yeah, it's sort of difficult to be that critical when I think that the bigger problem is just the scale of sporting events have really snowballed and got so big. And it's kind of like I'm a hypocrite, I guess, because I love it when you watch the Olympics and you have new sports like climbing or whatever that are in. But they're trying to at least limit the number of extra athletes and extra venues you have to build now, but it's just got so big. And I think, given by the number of referendums that are lost in terms of bidding for the Olympics, people are questioning why you would spend so much money on sport, hosting sports events and building sports venues when there's so many other problems in the world. And you can obviously claim there's been a big legacy benefit. London 2012 is a good
I don't think you
example of
can
that.
claim. No, I don't think you
No,
can
well,
claim it. Yeah.
you can claim it, but whether it's true or not is another thing. I
I
mean, both
both
in
I
terms
think they
of.
found for athletics in particular and those sports, there's been no legacy.
Both in terms of elite athletics and grassroots athletics, right? And also, I don't know, Stratford has been redeveloped as part of the Olympic Park, but has it pushed people out? Has it actually helped? I can't really answer that. But and London is considered one of the great success stories. Rio, for example, you've just got all these white elephants and all sorts of scandals involving the venues. And yeah, I would say that the main benefit for me of hosting the Olympics is you have a good sort of 2 week party. And beyond that, I'm not quite sure what they do, but yeah.
I think it brings a confidence to a nation and a connectedness to a city that you can't get other than maybe the odd royal wedding or some
Yeah,
other.
but on the other hand, London, I remember, was quieter during the Olympics than the rest of the time in a lot of parts because people had gone away deliberately to coincide. So it doesn't, they often say, oh, it'll help local businesses, and I'm not sure if that's fully true. It depends where you are, I guess. And it's so restricted. It's such a commercial event, like you can only use a Visa card, you can only go to McDonald's, or you can only drink Coca-Cola. So for every business that benefits from the Olympics, others are excluded.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually. Yeah, and those are then multinational companies that are whitewashing themselves, their the sugar and the fat content. And if where I guess to round off, where do you see the are there other areas that you think what are there any sports that you think are relatively clean? And are there any other countries that you think are going to be the next hotspots for you of future doping?
I think there's definitely sports which don't have as big a doping problem, probably the ones you'd expect, that there's not as much of a benefit. That doesn't mean there's no doping, but less. But sometimes those sports have other problems, be it match fixing or whatever. I mean, we did a, I wasn't as closely involved, but we did a documentary last year about, it was a horrible story, actually, a German diver in the, he competed in the 80s, 90s, 2000s, and basically was sexually abused by his coach for years and years. And it was all sort of covered up. And some of the people involved were still in prominent positions in the federation. And we've seen quite a lot of stories like that around the world of sports. So I think that's another issue that happens and needs to be, obviously, there was the Larry Nassar story in gymnastics, doctor. And that's something that it's the same issues, basically power and politics and protecting organizations over the voice of athletes. And so that's something which I think will happen more. In terms of doping countries, I'm not sure. I think I we are feeling as there is a big doping problem in some Western countries. How exactly it works is it's hard to get to the bottom of, and we would like to do that more.
Systematic or
Well, not systematic in the same way, because like they don't work in an autocratic way, so it's not like state sponsored as such. But I mean, if you look at, say, baseball or athletics back in the early 2000s in the USA, for example, it wasn't state sponsored, but you had coaching groups. It was done in a sort
different
of different way.
systems.
Yeah, different systems. And yeah, I feel not maybe not athletics, as you mentioned Sebastian Coe. I think he's definitely not perfect, but he's done more than 99% of sports federations to actually try and deal with doping. And I think athletics is better than some, but you see the times being run at the moment. Obviously, the shoes are making a difference as well, but it does make you suspicious still. And I think other sports aren't even trying to deal with it. Swimming is a bad one. Their governing body don't care.
And do you see the enhanced games as making any impact, or is it just a circus show?
That's a bit of a joke. It's just attention seeking. But I suspect that they wouldn't break world records because the world records we have are often the consequence of doping anyway. So
yeah, my better athletes.
Yeah, precisely. My guess would be they wouldn't be doing much quicker. But I think it's a bad thing. It's dangerous, and it's basically claiming that, like, you look at the number of athletes from the 70s and 80s who've died age 40, 50 from liver failure and other things. Doping is very dangerous and a bad thing to do, and bad for young people to do particularly. And yeah, it's not something that should be sort of glorified like the Enhanced Games does.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Really interesting. If people want to follow future articles you write or your opinion on things, what's the best way for them to do that?
Well, all our stories are on ARD, German television, but we tend to publish in German with English subtitles. But my Twitter is Nick JM Butler, @NickJMButler, so on there as well.
And if there's anything we can do as a podcast to help in the future, if you ever need feedback on things or connections in ways that we've got many tentacles. Please do reach out and let us know, because we're fascinated in the story, but also would love to have a clean world without social injustice as well. So thank you so much for helping in the battle. Thanks, Nick. We're coming back on, guys, because I've just realized I'd love to get Nick's viewpoint on something. So I've got friends in doping in various organizations. So I get fed information, but also their viewpoint on what something actually means. So someone like Stian Ungerman, who is a friend of mine, who I genuinely don't think he would ever dope, and I'd be heartbroken if I found out he had. He's been given a 2-year ban for I can't remember the name of the drug. I'll look it up. So, and for me, what I'm kind of intrigued is another friend of mine who is involved in doping has suggested that the fact he's been given a 2-year ban is because they think he probably is guilty of the, let's have a look, what the, just trying to do, see what the item is. In fact, it just says prohibitive substance. I'm just still trying to find. So when they give out these bans, sometimes you get 6 months, sometimes you get 2 years, all these things. Does the fact that he was just given a straight up 2-year ban, which is, I think, almost the maximum term for, so it was a masking agent in one of his urine tests. Is that reflective of almost whether they think they're guilty or not?
No. Well, the automatic suspension would be 4 years now since 2015. So if they felt he was 100% guilty, they would have given him 4 years.
Okay.
It
was chlorothalidone, a diuretic.
So, I mean, I don't know specifically about that substance, but diuretics generally have been found in supplements.
Yeah.
So it could be inadvertent. The problem is, I mean, the diuretics are also taken deliberately. So to be clear, both to bring weight down. So often in sports like gymnastics, because it speeds up water excretion from a body, and also as a masking agent, as you said, for hiding other substances. But what they do is, and this is why our China story was interesting, if you test positive, you are guilty. It's like reversal of the burden of proof. It's the opposite from most other walks of life. Drink driving is maybe the only one that's the same. But so you have to prove conclusively that you didn't dope. So what I expect in a lot of cases, basically people prove they didn't have a deliberate intent to dope, but they can't conclusively prove they didn't do anything wrong. So maybe if he took a supplement and it contained this diuretic, they say you're guilty not of deliberate doping, but of negligence for not being more careful. So we give you a 2-year suspension. And the trouble is, it's often much easier. They want to boost their statistics and make it look like they're taking it seriously. So they often go after the easy fish and the people who don't have access to legal teams. And yeah, so I think it's very inconsistently applied. And yeah, it's often the smaller people who get punished rather than being protected elite athletes, which for me should be the focus of anti-doping.
Yeah, I think that's the challenge, isn't it? It's how do you track everything you've ever taken? Although I think CJ Uja, who took some Amazon supplements and cost the medal, and you think there are some things where you wouldn't take, but okay, so yeah, that's
we had a case. There was a German Swiss handball player, Simon Getzmann, and he tested positive. I can't remember the substance, but he couldn't understand why he spent a lot of his own money in trying to prove it. And then he found a packet of painkillers. And there was one tablet left in the packet. He sent the packet to a lab and they found that they were contaminated with this substance. So because it shouldn't have been in the painkiller, it was just a paracetamol, I think, he got completely let off. Didn't get any ban, but he'd spent a huge amount of money in proving that of his own money. So it's still, I guess, still punished.
So you almost need to ensure anything, if you are taking anything, even if it is cleared, that you always keep one or two of them.
Yeah, and you should. Yeah, obviously with paracetamol, it's ridiculous. They shouldn't be contaminated. Yeah. But with any supplement, you should definitely send it to people beforehand and test it. But the trouble is, there's definitely been a lot of times where people have used that as an excuse when they've been deliberately doping. So you can sort of understand why sports bodies are skeptical. But yeah, it definitely can, for certain substances where they can be contaminated.
Yeah. Okay. Makes sense. Cool. Well, thanks for clarifying that. And
good.
And again, if there's any other stories you want to come and talk about, let us know. We'd love to have you.
Will do.
Cheers, Nick. Chat soon.
Thanks a lot, David.
So there you go, Deep Batters. A bit of an extra addendum at the end there, because it just suddenly occurred to me, and I'd love to be able to clear Steen's name if possible, or help in some way. But do you guys, if you liked this episode, we've mentioned a little bit about some other stories. We spoke to the Stepanovs, who were two Russian, one athlete, one anti-doping. They were married to each other, and they actually turned whistleblowers and escaped via Germany to now live in America. We interviewed them. That was set up by Rob Kohler, who we'd interviewed as well in the past. Look that up. It's a really good interview. He was ex-deputy director of WADA, and he was so disillusioned with how the doping system worked that he then set up Global Athlete, a lobbying organization with the intent of trying to represent the viewpoints of athletes to these agencies, but also to try and enforce the inclusion of athletes in the boards. Current athletes, not ex-athletes, in the boards of the organisations, to try and ensure that there was a fairer system. Those two are really, really good episodes worth listening to. If you've got any suggestions of future ones, let me know. Please do rate, review, subscribe, all that jazz, and we'll see you next time. Bye 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 bye. And give me one more try, 'cause a love like this should I never ever die. Come back. Fuck you, buddy.